This is the first day of this November 2011 7-day session. And for the first few days of the session, we're going to read from the teachings of the Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim. Sunim is the Korean version of Roshi. And we'll be reading from a book called The Way of Korean Zen. We've read from this several times over the years. Last time was like 2.5 years ago. And the material here is translated by Martina Fage, Stephen Batchelor, and Top K something or other. First, about his life. Kusan Sunim was born near a small country town in the southwest of Korea in 1909. His parents owned a medium-sized farm, and family life was centered around work in the fields. Although his parents were Buddhist, he attended classes at the local Confucian school, where he studied the Chinese classics until he was about 15. Then when he left school, he continued to help on the family farm and worked as a barber until he was 29. And during this time, he got married. It says here that from an early age, he had always been drawn to the monastic way of life. And these are his own words. When I was 9 years old, I remember thinking, could it be possible for someone to be without birth and death? Was it possible to have unlimited powers to move freely through the sky and on the earth? Such thoughts made me want to go and live with the monks in the mountains, but the fear of missing my parents prevented me from leaving home then. When I was 20, I also considered such a life, but I was not sufficiently determined. Let me just comment that ideally, becoming ordained is something that you grow into if you're going to do it. A lot of people very early in their practice have this ideal of monasticism and want to get ordained. I feel that it's better to wait until the person has shown a real affinity for the monastic life. Every once in a while, I get a letter from someone who's either, usually it's someone who hasn't even been to a workshop. They've never been to the Zen Center. They've never practiced Zen, and they say, I want to become a monk. And I write them back and say, well, first spend some time on staff, living in a somewhat monastic-like life, and spend a few years doing that, and then we'll talk. For myself, I remember after my first sesshin, I think, I was on fire to get ordained and talk to Roshi Kaplow about it. At that time, though, you had to literally leave home. You had to break your relations with your parents, your family, and it was the traditional celibate monastic ordination. And I realized after he agreed to ordain me as a celibate monk that that was more in my head. The rest of me hadn't caught up to to that ideal, that aspiration, and it was a couple years later then that I was ordained. At the time, it was the only way, and still is the only way we have people ordained at the Zen Center, is where if you're not, no vows of celibacy, and no need to break your connections with your family. He continues, at the age of 26, he was stricken by a severe illness that caused him a great deal of pain. When a friend saw him in this condition, and this friend was a devout Buddhist layman, he asked him, since the abode of the self-nature is originally pure, where does your illness lie? Well, these words had a deep effect on Kusan. And so he decided to go to a nearby monastery and recite the mantra of Avalokiteshvara. And this is Om Mani Padme Hum for 100 days. This, by the way, is the most common chant done in Tibet. At least judging by what I saw when I was there, what I heard, many, many, many hundreds of people I came across who were doing their devotional practice and chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. So he did this for 100 days, and by the end, he found himself cured of his illness. And of course, this experience left him his faith much strengthened, his faith in the Dharma. Three years later, he became convinced that he should dedicate his life to the full-time practice of the Dharma. And to do this, he left his home and family and started traveling to various monasteries in order to find a teacher. He visited 11 different temples, and he finally came to Songguang Sa. Sa is it means temple or monastery. That's the same. That's the Korean equivalent of G. The word G in Japanese. In G, it's Bukokuji, Sogenji, Daitokuji. In Korean, it's Sa. And he came to the Songguang Sa. I'm going to turn back now and read a little bit about. There's a short chapter that precedes this biographical chapter. There's a short chapter about life in a Korean Zen monastery, and it focuses on this Songguang Sa. I always find it interesting, the similarities and the differences from our own Zen center. It begins, the principal Buddhist monasteries in Korea today are usually one of two kinds. They either serve as centers for the study of the Buddhist sutras, or they provide facilities for Zen meditation. Some of the larger monasteries accommodate both possibilities, one section being used for studying the sutras, and another enclosed area housing a hall for meditation. After a young monk has completed a postulancy period of several months and received ordination as a novice, then he chooses whether to enter the sutra school or the meditation hall. If he chooses the sutra school, he may embark on a training period of up to 6 years during which time he is primarily engaged in the study of the Buddhist sutras. If he chooses the latter alternative, he enters a meditation hall and devotes himself to the practice of Zen. It is quite common for monks to go to a meditation hall after completing their training in sutra study. It's not the same in Japan. Maybe there are some temples that do it this way in Japan, but from everything I've ever heard and what I experienced while I was in Japan, you don't have this high regard, this honoring of studying sutras, at least not equal to doing zazen. As far as I can tell, in Japan, it's the emphasis falls squarely on the actual practice and not the study. Although in the Soto school, I've heard of a role of studying the works of Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, and others. And then there's this description of Songguang Sa. It was established at the beginning of the 13th century by Chinul. Some of you will recognize that name. We've read from the teachings of Chinul from the 13th century. Little description here. Songguang Sa is reached by a narrow, unpaved road that winds gently up from the valley below. The monastery itself is nestled in a circle of steep, forested hills, insulated by nature from the disturbances of the outside world. The monastery complex itself is formed around a spacious square courtyard. Dominating this open space is the main Buddha hall, an impressive wooden structure mounted with an imposing yet delicate Chinese-style slate roof. By the way, in our 100-year plan for Chapin Mill, we laid out a location for a Buddha hall separate from the Zendo here. But we won't be doing that, starting that anytime soon. By the way, the place where we thought of it was behind the farmhouse in that kind of elevated peninsula that leads toward Roshi Kaplow's grave. That's where we thought of having the Buddha hall, if we ever have one. The walls of the Buddha hall at Songguang Sa are decorated with colorful figures from the Buddhist pantheon, scenes from the lives of famous monks, and landscapes. The ceiling is adorned with a profusion of multicolored interweaving patterns and motifs. Maybe someday we'll bring some color here into the Zendo. I'm still hoping before the Zendo is to have the hall in the northeast part of the building here that runs alongside the Doksan line, to have the wall on the other side from the Doksan waiting line, to have that painted. And then the meditation hall is right behind the Buddha hall, elevated about 50 feet up on the hillside. This area is sealed off from the rest of the monastery and is only accessible to those monks undergoing training in Zen meditation. It overlooks the entire monastery and offers a panoramic view of the surrounding hills and mountains. Once a monk has been formally accepted into the community, he then moves into the meditation hall and installs what few possessions he has in a locker. So that's interesting. They have lockers in the Zendo. He's assigned a place in one of the two rows of meditation cushions that run down the length of the hall. This was also true in the temples I trained at in Japan. You have an assigned seat in the Zendo, and that's yours, in Sesshin and out. And they sleep here in Songguangsa. They sleep in the Zendo. The walls and ceiling are white. And this is interesting. In the middle of a long back wall is a small altar above which hangs a mirror symbolizing true mind. So instead of a Buddha, apparently, I don't know, it doesn't say there's no Buddha, but a mirror. The floor is covered with varnished yellow ochre paper and is heated from below by a wood fire. During the day, the Zendo is illuminated by soft natural light, and then after dusk, a dull electric lamp is used. The day at Songguangsa, the day begins at 3 o'clock in the morning with a short chanting service. Then they do Zazen. The sitting periods are 50 minutes. It's 5-0, 50 minutes. And then they have 10 minutes of walking briskly around the hall. And this goes on until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, same as ours. 3 daily meals. The meals are in 1-hour breaks. The monks can rest or go for short walks in the surrounding hills. They have a midday chanting right before lunch. All 3 meals of the day are basically identical. They're served water, rice, and soup. I think it looks like the only formal meal accompanied by chanting is at the lunch meal, sort of the opposite of ours. When the meal is over, not a grain of rice nor a drop of water remains on the floor. Now this is interesting. The master gives the Dharma talk only every 2 weeks. Well, I guess that's more or less the same as we have in Rochester, outside of Sesshin. Whenever a monk wishes to see the Zen master in private to discuss some aspect of his practice, he is encouraged to visit the master in his quarters. However, regular interviews at which the master keeps a close check on the progress of the student's meditation are not common in the Korean tradition. Well, that's all the time we have. So this, I hope, gives some sense of what life was like there at Songguangsa. I wanted to take the time to read that because this is a very this monastery is central to Korean Zen and to the story of Kusan Sunim. So again, after Kusan visited 11 different temples, he came to this Songwangsa, and then he met his master Hyobong. Now, I'm going to pause again to read a little bit about this master of Kusan Sunim, this Hyobong. He was born in 1888. As a young man, he studied law. And during the Japanese occupation, he was the first Korean who was permitted to become a judge. Since many Koreans strongly resisted the Japanese rule, he was often forced to pass judgment on fellow countrymen accused of anti-Japanese activities. This became an increasing source of conflict for him. Well, he managed to continue as a judge for 10 years, and then a case came up before him in which he was forced to sentence the prisoner to death. And this provoked in him deep questioning about what rights he had to impose judgment on others. He began to doubt the validity of the entire legal system and the society that supported it. And so one day he decided that he could no longer continue in such a position. Without telling anyone, that's the interesting part, without telling anyone, he suddenly left his work and home and became a wandering toffee seller. Toffee is a type of taffy, candy. Yeah, I know a lot of people who went from being a judge to a toffee seller. For the next 3 years, he drifted through the country, barely supporting himself by selling toffee. All this time, he reflected upon how he could lead a true and honest human life. He finally decided to enter a monastery and start practicing meditation. Now remember, we're still talking about Hyobong, Kusan's teacher. He was already 39 years old when he received ordination. For many years, he stayed in retreat, concentrating solely on resolving the koan mu. When he was 43, he built himself a tiny hermitage and sealed himself inside. I've heard of this in Tibet, but I hadn't heard of it outside of Tibet. He left just one small hole in the wall through which food could be passed in and out. And he stayed in this little cave for 1.5 years in its complete solitude. Finally, his mind's eye opened and he realized that at last all of his doubts had been resolved. And he wrote the following verse. At the bottom of the ocean, a deer hatches an egg in a swallow's nest. In the heart of a fire, a fish boils tea in a spider's web. Who knows what is happening in this house? White clouds float westward. The moon rises in the east. During the next 30 years, Master Hyobong became a widely known and respected teacher, and he was eventually appointed the spiritual head of the Chogye order, which is the biggest order of monks in Korea. Now, back to Kusan Sunim. When he met this Master Hyobong, he told him that he wished to become a monk, and he asked him to take him as a disciple. Master Hyobong agreed and instructed him in the koan mu. 8 months later, he received novice ordination, that's Kusan Sunim, and he entered the meditation hall in Songwangsa under the guidance of his teacher. Then when he was 31, he took full ordination as a bhikshu, a celibate monk. From the beginning, Master Kusan was only interested in the practice of Zen and never attended a sutra school to study the Buddhist scriptures. And these are his own words. I chose to enter the Zen sect because I thought that through meditation, I would be able to free myself from birth and death and gain the power to transform this world into a Buddha realm. In the sutra schools, one is only told about cultivating the mind and awakening. I felt it would be better to actually realize these things instead. As soon as he took up the practice of meditation, he did so with a tremendous resolve and determination. When I started meditating, I was firmly convinced that I would be able to complete the practice within the 3 months of the first retreat period. I exerted myself to the point where I no longer cared whether I lived or died. But as the 3 months drew to an end, and I had still not realized my goal, I wanted to die, since I felt it was no longer worth living. Let me just comment on this briefly. I remember hearing about this, not in this book, but about other earlier masters in China and Japan who felt like they just wanted to die when they hadn't attained awakening. And early on, this made no sense to me. But later, when I reached a certain level of desperation myself, I know I could understand this feeling. One who hasn't reached this state of desperation perhaps never could understand it. But it's a very promising state, actually. Once, while doing standing meditation in order to prevent drowsiness, I thought of drowning myself or throwing myself off a high cliff. But at that very moment, a huge snow-capped mountain appeared before me, Makyo, obviously. This made me remember that the Buddha had practiced for 6 full years at the feet of such mountains. I then realized that it was somewhat presumptuous for me to want to complete my training in 3 months. Thereupon, I renounced my intention to die and redoubled my efforts. Probably most of you can appreciate that there's a strong element of grasping behind this setting a time period and saying I have to do it within whatever, 3 months or 6 months or whatever. It's both, though. It's the grasping is a hindrance. As long as you're setting a goal and clinging to the goal in your mind, then you're going to be blocked from it. But at the same time, it shows a tremendous aspiration and determination also. And as he went on, then the grasping quality of that aspiration, that became purified. During the following years, Kusan Sunim continued to pursue his practice of meditation. After spending a number of seasons in meditation halls, he decided that he needed the solitude of a hermitage in order to be able to concentrate himself fully on his practice. Thus, he would spend his time in small, remote hermitages, often completely by himself. And then these are his words. At these times, when I was hungry, I would find something to eat. When thirsty, I would drink. When the room was cold, I would light a fire under the floor. I tried to practice as hard as I could and would sleep very little. His disciples recall that in those days, Master Kusan was a very stern and even frightening figure. He would demand exemplary conduct from all the younger students of his teacher and urge them to work hard all day and meditate through the night. He would constantly remind them that they never knew when they might die, that they would be finished should the mere breath in their nostrils come to a stop. If a young monk were to waste a few grains of rice or a single cabbage leaf, as a punishment, he would sometimes make him go without food for the rest of the day. Something for people working in the kitchen to bear in mind. We want to never waste food. He himself was a devoted disciple to his teacher and a tireless worker. His first important experience in his meditation came while he was practicing at such and such hermitage. It occurred after he had been meditating continuously for 7 days with the intense resolve to awaken before the memorial ceremony for a close friend who had recently died. However, he did not consider this a true awakening. These are his words. While meditating, such experiences sometimes happen. You could say it was a certain opening of the mind's eye. It was the transition over a difficult step that enabled me to first gain admittance to the door. Perhaps you could call it an initial breakthrough. It showed that my practice was progressing well. Well, that's just what I would call it, an initial breakthrough. This is what in our tradition would be passing your first koan, which is not the same as true enlightenment. He then went to another small hermitage that he had built. He stayed there for 3 years, and in 1946 he experienced a major breakthrough. This occurred after he had entered a state in which for 15 days he lost any sense of the outside world. He was no longer concerned whether he lived or died. He was so absorbed in his meditation that birds would come and sit on his head and shoulders and take pieces of stuffing that protruded from his padded coat for their nests. After this, he came down to the main temple in the hermitage, the nearby monastery, and delivered a formal Dharma discourse to the monks. Let me just comment on the state of samadhi that he got into. This is a true samadhi. People sometimes use that word rather loosely. They casually report that they got into a samadhi this morning or a samadhi this or that. I think it's best to be careful in using that word. There are different degrees of samadhi. You could say that getting into a state of no thought is a kind of light samadhi, but this was not a light samadhi, obviously. And the fact that he lost any sense of the outside world, this is what distinguishes samadhi from mindfulness. These are really, it's, I think, a useful distinction to understand that in samadhi, you can lose touch with things completely. Whereas mindfulness is a different aspect of Buddhist meditation, a very useful, very important aspect of Buddhist meditation. In mindfulness, you're very much aware of things around you, people. But in samadhi, not necessarily so. If you're standing in a doorway and someone is approaching carrying a bag of rice, let's say, if you're in a samadhi, you may not be aware of the person approaching. But if you're mindful, then you're going to notice and get out of the way so the person, maybe open the door for the person. In Zen, at least, well into one's practice, the emphasis falls on the samadhi. That is in a practice of Zen in which a breakthrough is emphasized, coming to awakening, coming to Kensho. This is what Hakuin emphasizes in the chant that we recite right before Teisho. One true samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma-dissolving obstructions. A truly mature practice of Zen will be embodying both of these. The ability to completely lose ourselves in the moment, and also the ability simultaneously to be mindful of everything that's happening around us and what the needs are of other people. Here's another way to understand the distinction. The monitors know that they and I, what we have to do in Sesshin is primarily mindfulness practice, to be aware of everyone else, to be able to respond, to help people, to anticipate problems, to deal with problems. This is all mindfulness, and it's done so that everyone else, all the other Sesshin participants, can just lose themselves, forget everything, and just plunge into absolute oneness with their practice. For the monitors and the teacher, the samadhi practice is something that is more likely to be able to fully bloom during informal sittings, when we don't have the responsibilities of the formal sittings, like such as at during yaza, late night sitting. Anyway, he had this major awakening, and he wrote a verse. Look at the front of the mirror. It is completely dark. Look at the back, and it is brilliantly clear. Looking at the front, it is not the front. Looking at the back, it is also not the back. When both front and back are shattered, then truly one has a great complete mirror. This front and back, this allusion to front and back, is really another way of expressing the twofold nature of reality. There's the side of the absolute, about which really nothing can be said, and there's the side of the relative, the side of form or phenomena. Ultimately, these two are not two. There's only one mirror. You can look at it from the back, you can look at it from the front. There's just this one mirror. But looked at from the back, it doesn't look the same as from the front. And then it goes on, shortly after the outbreak of the Korean War, communist forces overran Haeyansa. That's where he was. That's where his hermitage was, and they took all the monks prisoner. But Kusan Sunim and Master Hyobong managed to avoid capture and escaped to the region around Busan, where UN forces were in control. One of the things I like about this book is that it brings up to nearly present day story of a great master. Most of the stories of great masters are from ancient times. Here, this brings us right up into the Korean War and beyond. I'll skip a little bit here now because we're running out of time. After the war, Master Kusan accepted a number of administrative positions to help with the Sangha. However, he still felt that his practice of meditation needed to be deepened. So he eventually resigned his posts and went to a small hermitage. He spent another 3 years in deep meditation there and then had another awakening. He reported it to his master, Hyobong, and he received Dharma transmission. and he composed the following lines. Penetrating deep into a pore of Samanta Bahadra, Manjusri is seized and defeated. Now the great earth is quiet. It is hot on the day of the winter equinox. Pine trees are of themselves green. A stone man riding on a crane passes over the blue mountains. Samanta Bahadra is the bodhisattva of action. On a traditional altar, you would have the Buddha at the center, and on his right would be Manjusri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, and as left would be Samanta Bahadra, the bodhisattva of action. In our chanting services, we abbreviate Samanta Bahadra just to Bahadra. Faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha brings true liberation. We now return the merit of our chanting to Shakyamuni Buddha, Manjusri Bodhisattva, Avalokita Bodhisattva, Bahadra. There's the Bahadra. Bahadra Bodhisattva. And in response to this verse, Master Hyobong told Kusan, until now you have been following me, now it is I who should follow you. And then Kusan Sunim got into traveling abroad. He came to the United States and other countries for a while. His teacher, Hyobong, passed away in 1966. And then Master Kusan became the abbot of Songguangsa. And one of his main tasks was the rebuilding of the Zendo, the meditation hall, which was completed in 1970. At the conclusion of his inaugural speech on this occasion, Master Kusan exhorted the monks who were present with these words, "In practicing meditation, you should be prepared to grab hold of the blade of a sword so sharp that it cuts through hairs merely blown against it. You would normally be afraid to take hold of such a sword even by its handle, because of the slightest slip you would be in danger of cutting yourself. Now you have to be prepared to seize it by the blade. Could you possibly do that in your ordinary frame of mind? As long as you are afraid of the sharpness of the blade, you are bound to cut yourself. But in firmly gripping the blade with an utterly intrepid mind, you will not even be scratched." Here, understand that he's talking about the kind of fears that one encounters in practice. Fear of not getting enough food or not getting the right kind of food, the kind of food one is accustomed to, the fear of getting sick, getting a cold, fear of going without much sleep. He's saying, if you're afraid of this, you're going to be captive to these fears. You're going to be weakened by them. Have to grab hold of this sword by the blade. In other words, thoroughly become one with it. And above all, don't sit and dwell in your thoughts about what you're afraid of. It's the biggest mistake we can make in Sesshin. Worrying about, well, if I stay up a little at night, then I may be tired in the morning. Shut up! Who cares? Everyone's tired in Sesshin. It's nothing to be afraid of. Get sick, get a cold. This is nothing. There's stories of the masters who would be near death with TB and other things and come out of it. We just read Kusan Sunim, being near death before becoming a monk, and how his faith, and in that case it was the faith in this mantra, how he credits that with having freed him from the sickness. Never doubt the power of mind to take us through any challenge, any obstacle. During his later years, the wrathful demeanor for which he was noted earlier in his life gave way to a kind and compassionate nature that always seemed to have room for any monk or lay person who was in need of his advice. He made his last trip to the United States in 1980. He inaugurated a Korean temple in Los Angeles. He lectured in Paris, Geneva, Copenhagen. And then in 1983, he began showing signs of illness, and he composed his final poem, "The autumn leaves covering the mountain are redder than flowers in spring. Everything in the universe fully reveals the great power. Life is void, and death is also void. Absorbed in the Buddha's ocean seal samadhi, I depart with a smile." This reminds me, if I may, reminds me of the state that our Dharma sister Ruth Kuntz is in now. I called her yesterday, and she's in such good cheer. She told me that they just moved. She's now in a hospital bed in her apartment, and they will soon move her into a hospice facility. But she was laughing and saying, "I'm at peace. I'm fine. It's going to be fine." The following day, he gathered his disciples in his room and indicated that he wouldn't be living for much longer. And from that point on, his health gradually deteriorated. And then in December, he died. His body was cremated in a small field behind the monastery. His bones were ground to powder and scattered near the site of his old hermitage at the foot of Mount Chogye. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.